dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, man whose intelligence, in every sense of the word, we've come to respect greatly and rely on considerably, is our first guest. He is Robert Charles. He served, among other things, as an Assistant Secretary of State with responsibility for narcotics and law enforcement affairs under the George W. Bush administration. He was a naval intelligence officer, served in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses. He has taught law. He is the author of a terrific book, Eagles and Evergreens, and a prodigious contributor to the public policy debate, notably through his appearances at Fox News and FoxNews.com and elsewhere. We're always delighted to catch up with him, especially today when we have learned that a woman responsible for the Department of Homeland Security under the Trump administration over the past 16 months has resigned her position. And the man charged with running the Customs and Border Patrol organization, Kevin McElneen, is replacing Kirstjen Nielsen. So to talk about that, among other things, I'm delighted to welcome back Robert Charles. Thank you for joining us, Bobby. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you for your kindness and for everything you do for America, Frank.
Thank you. Well, so tell us about Kirstjen Nielsen, how she got the job in the first place, how she did as Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, and why she's leaving now.
You know, Frank, in many ways, this is like successive general officers in the midst of combat, in the middle of a war zone. There are natural moments when it's appropriate to make a transition. She was elevated, I think, to that spot because she was very close to John Kelly, who at the time was the chief of staff. Had enormous respect for John Kelly, former himself head of DHS, former general officer of a great renown. And so John Kelly rolled out, and these are high intensity jobs. This one has gotten more and more high intensity as time has passed. And I think she probably just thought, with the president's accommodation, that this was the right time to go, and he may have thought the same thing. The bottom line is, on the border today, we have just go to the numbers. The numbers are powerful. A year ago, January and February of a year ago, you had an elevating, rising trend line on deportations by Mexico back to Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador. And at the same time, you had a declining number of border crossers. So it had dropped from about 70,000 down to 50,000 and was going south. Today, we have exactly the reverse. You have a declining number of deportations by Mexico back to Guatemala, dramatically declining. And you also have a dramatic rise in the border crossers for a number of reasons. But December, January, February, you had a shift from roughly below 50,000 up again toward north of 70,000. And in March, you had them flying over the border at 100,000 in the month of March. Now, the demographics are also changing. They've decided the president's absolutely right. It's a scam. What they've done is they've told these people, if you can get into the United States, you'll get a free pass for a period of time. In 6 months, you can get a work permit. If you claim asylum and you do and you say these various things, and they put them on air-conditioned buses down in Central America and ship them up to Mexico. Mexico has taken more of a hands-off perspective on this thing. And so the president, you know, really threw down the gauntlet in the last 2 weeks. He said initially he would consider closing the border, which incidentally could be done at one or rolling locations or the entire border. He said we're going to move to tariffs. And what he's really saying is, get your act together. You're an ally. You are one of our major trading partners. You need to remember the rule of law and you need to enforce it. And we are not going to play games anymore. Nielsen, obviously, that's a new and more direct message. And maybe Nielsen at this moment wasn't the right person for that message. Maybe another general officer needs to fleet up, which is what seems to be happening from CBP.
Well, he's a good pick, it seems to me, at least on an interim basis, to run this operation if the border and its security and the enforcement of the laws with respect to illegal immigration is as important, indeed critical, an activity as it is at the moment, Robert. And I just think that it's time, perhaps past time, that you saw the president pull in this kind of leadership at DHS.
Look, there's an idea in the law called exhaustion of remedies, which is means that you climb a ladder, a series of rungs, and you try the first thing, and if it doesn't work, you go to the second. The president has been very patient. He's tried in his budgets to put forward the idea of a well-funded wall. He's finally had to pull the trigger on a technical national emergency, which is really a reflection of a tipping point that is very real and visible on the border and frankly all over the United States. He's made leadership changes in this direction. And, you know, this is the moment in time when you pull an operations sensitive person to that role. You know, in the Navy, they call a person who has gone through all the E's and then ended up in the O's, you know, going from enlisted to officer, they call him a Mustang. And one of the things that happens with someone who knows how to change the oil in the car, has carried and used a firearm, is able to manage the day-to-day events, is that when they get into a policy role, they know exactly what's going on in the field. And it's an extremely, it's a pivot to someone in this case that, you know, moving from leadership of CBP, I think, to DHS, it's a pivot to say we're dead serious. We're pulling somebody into the fray right now, and probably anybody that succeeds him, who is not only seasoned but resolved and experienced. And we're going to make it clear that this is truly a battle that we're going to win, because frankly, our sovereignty depends on it.
Yeah. It's not just our sovereignty, of course, Bobby, as you and I have talked about on repeated occasions. It's our public health. It's our economic well-being as this social safety net groans under the additional burden of untold numbers of people coming here illegally and immediately on the grounds that they have been given asylum or turned loose in the country, they get access to it. And ultimately, it is about the homeland security as well as our national security and, as you say, sovereignty. So for all these reasons, let's hope that this new, at least interim, leadership at DHS is going to up our game dramatically. We certainly need it. Hey, Bobby, there's one other thing that was going down today that I wanted to make sure I touched base with you on. The president has designated the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization, foreign terrorist organization. This certainly seems to me to have been long overdue. Give us a flavor of why this is an important step, particularly at this moment in time with Iran increasingly thrashing around, notably in Syria.
Well, it is an important step, Frank. And I think if you just look at it from a distance for a moment, this is a president who calls it like it is. And Mike Pompeo is cut from that same cloth, as are several others around him. They don't sugarcoat it. And for many years, I'll say decades, actually, two things have occurred, which are sort of secrets that are untold. One is that state actors, particularly Iran, that were involved in both promoting and in many ways populating and financing and operating terrorist-related activities, were not called FTOs and foreign terrorist organizations under the State Department's designation. So the first thing he's doing is he's pulling the Band-Aid off that, or he's pulling the curtain back on that and saying and no more pretending that Iran is acting like a normal, legitimate state.
Bobby, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time today, as well as the enormous contributions, as I say, that you continue to make now out of government to the security and safety of the American people. We appreciate it very much.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined live from the frontier between Israel and Lebanon by our foreign correspondent par excellence. His name is Dr. Harold Rode. Dr. Rode is one of the country's experts on the Middle East, and in particular on the various threats that we, as well as Israel, face from the likes of Iran and Turkey and the Muslim Brotherhood and so on. He is the author most recently of Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. Always a welcome guest, and I benefit enormously from the writings that he periodically provides to us through his work at the Gatestone Institute. I commend them to you. And I'm always grateful for his long service to our country in the Defense Department, where he was for years really the duty expert on the Middle East for successive secretaries of defense. Harold Rode, it's good to have you back, my friend, and welcome, especially coming to us live from a very interesting part of the world.
Thanks. It's nice to be there, Frank.
So tomorrow there will be elections in Israel, and I'd like you to make book for us, Harold. I was listening to the National Public Radio broadcast this morning, and there was some musing that Bibi may not prevail in terms of his own party, but the right is likely to enjoy broad support, and therefore he will likely form another government with support from other smaller right-wing parties. And the host sort of opined that this is a function of Bibi Netanyahu transforming the political environment in Israel. And I wonder what you make of that, whether that's the case or indeed how this election may turn out as you see it.
Well, the reason this is a, shall we say, a right-wing country is because this is the reality here. In America, we have the luxury of intellectuality. We can talk and all that, but we don't have to experience day-to-day what the people who live in Israel do.
Which is mortal peril, I think it's fair to say, is it not?
Absolutely. The bottom line is that the Muslims surrounding Israel have not decided they want to live with a Jewish state because this is Islamic territory from their point of view. And there can't be peace. Now, Israelis have to live with this on a day-to-day basis. I'm here up on the Lebanese-Israel border, and it's been quiet here lately, but the truth is that at times the people here are worried that people across the border in Lebanon are going to shoot rockets, which could go anywhere. This is their reality, and that's why they're right-wing.
Rockets and missiles, by some estimates, over 100,000 of them pointed by Hezbollah at Israel, some capable of ranging the entire country. So this is, the old expression, Harold, about a conservative being a liberal who was mugged by reality. And it certainly sounds as though Israel has been repeatedly mugged by reality. Harold, this brings me to one of the promises that Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister, has made that if reelected, he will do to parts of the West Bank, as it's known these days, Judea and Samaria, as it has been historically known, as was done previously by the Israeli government with respect to the Golan, namely its annexation, the sovereign control established on a permanent basis by Israel. The president of the United States, Donald Trump, of course, recently formally acknowledged that was the case in the Golan, and I'm wondering whether the same logic that prompted him to do that might not prompt him in the future to do the same should parts of the West Bank be annexed by Israel as well.
It sounds like the right idea here. Here's the problem, Frank. Why the Golan? Modern diplomacy, frankly, is based on 1647, the Treaty of Westphalia, which says as follows: you have your country, I have my country. But if you use your territory to attack me or my people, then I have the right to come and take it over. That's what Israel did in the Golan Heights. And all President Trump did was recognize that reality. If you go to the Golan Heights, you will see that it overlooks all of northern Israel. On a clear day, you can even see to the Mediterranean coast. That's on the other side of Israel. And that's what the Syrians did before. So Israel can't give up that territory. The Syrians don't want to live in peace with Israel. Regarding the Judea and Samaria, which, as you said, is the ancient terms for names of this area, which we have decided to call the West Bank, and frankly, more and more today are again reverting to those ancient terms, Judea and Samaria, from the Bible. The same problem occurs. That if the Muslims in that area are prepared to live in peace with the Jews, there's no problem. And the problem is they are not. They teach their children from the time that they're little to hate Israel, to hate the Jews, that the Jewish state has no right to be here. This is Islamic territory. And their method of fighting is, again, you mentioned the book that I wrote for the center is it's Islamic territory. If they are prepared to live in peace, everything is possible. But until then, if they're not, then what President Trump recognized for the Golan seems to me the same vis-a-vis the Judea and Samaria. If they're not prepared to live in peace, Israel must take care of security of its people. And so we'll see what happens. It wouldn't surprise me if certain areas which are Jewish majority in Judea and Samaria are annexed.
Yeah. Assuming, that is, that Bibi Netanyahu is given a new mandate as prime minister, is that how you think it's going to play out, Harold Rode?
I think with time, yes. Let me just say the following. What can we expect of these elections tomorrow? Now, the polling here leaves a bit to be desired. For example, I am an American. I'm not Israeli. I have an Israeli cell phone, and frankly, you're talking to me on that cell phone right now. I have gotten four or five survey requests, polling requests, and they list the number of parties, and you put a number in for the one you're going to vote for. No, I can't vote. I'm not Israeli. In iInvertible, they do 13. To make their survey look stupid, I vote for number 26, which does not exist. Many Israelis that I knew do their damnedest to do exactly the same. They hate the pollsters, and they lie to them. Let me just give you a sense, and it's only a sense of what I think is going to happen. And I'm going to quote here my barber here in Tel Aviv. Why do I quote him? These people know more than anything. I've known him for many years. He's never been wrong. He says that it's almost assuredly going to be Netanyahu tomorrow. And he said, Benny Gantz, who is the, let's call him the leftist general on the other side, is going to have a big surprise, one that he doesn't want. Now, I don't know what's true. All I know is by talking all over the country, and I've been in the last few days in various, everything north of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, I've been all over the place. Everybody seems to say more or less the same thing. Are they going to vote for Netanyahu, who represents the right? Or are they going to vote for smaller parties on the right?
Either way, that is likely to conduce to his being the new premier. Harold, we have to move along because I want to cover two other things before we run out of time. This is a moment when you were talking about the irreconcilable enemies of Israel who will not make peace with her. Of course, one of those, as you know better than just about anybody in America at least, is Iran. Iran is increasingly a force in Syria. I've even been told that the Russian naval base there is now going to be controlled by the Iranians. They are also at the foot of the Golan Heights, which makes, again, all the more important, Israel having acknowledged sovereign control of that territory and the ability to project power from it. Talk quickly about the Iranian play at the moment, Harold, and how that will likely affect Israel's openness to making any concessions in this environment to its adversaries if there is a Trump peace plan, which the president again said at the Republican Jewish Coalition meeting in Las Vegas recently, is going to be in the offing once the election dust has settled.
Well, let me say first on Syria, we seem to think that Russia and Iran are allies. They're tremendous enemies. Assad, the president of the dictator of Syria, has what they think they say is an army. There's not much left. Part is really loyal to Russia. Part is loyal to Iran. Iran, thank God, is being squeezed by the American administration. And they're being pushed into the corner. And hopefully the people of Iran will find an opportunity and put an end to this awful regime, which not only threatens to destroy Israel, but its real enemy are the Sunnis, symbolized here by Saudi Arabia. And Iran wants to destroy Saudi Arabia. I'm very sure, I don't know, that Israel is helping out there, and America is helping out there. all of which is, as far as I'm concerned, a very good thing. And let us hope that at some point in the not-too-distant future, that we will wake up and there'll be a new government in Iran, one that wants to get along with the United States, with Israel. And this is not a pipe dream. This may take time, but we're on that path, and the American administration's policies are superb. Slowly but surely, more and more sanctions. I don't know, but I have little doubt that Israel and America are working together, because they're both doing, they both want the same thing.
Let us hope that there is in the offing, Harold Rhodes, something you've devoted much of your professional life to accomplishing, which is the end of this horrible regime in Iran and the makings for an authentic peace between Israel and its neighbors. We will be watching it closely, but not holding our breath. Harold, thank you for your time today, as always, and your great service to our country, which continues today at the Gatestone Institute. We'll talk with you soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for our visit on the other side of the world, virtually at least, with our friend and colleague Gordon Chang, one of the featured regulars on this program whose expertise on matters involving Asia is, well, unsurpassed by my lights, and makes him, of course, a regular at Fox News and a contributor to the Daily Beast, a regular author at The National Interest, as well as, of course, his three terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and most recently, Losing South Korea, a topic that we will turn to with him in a moment. Gordon, let me first say welcome. It's always good to have you with us. Glad to have you aboard.
Thank you so much, Frank.
So, Gordon, there are several things that are happening this week that I wanted to take note of. One is we're having a meeting tomorrow, which I'm very pleased that you will be addressing. It is a roundtable discussion sponsored by the Committee on the Present Danger, China, in which you will be talking, among other things, about bilateral trade. This has, of course, been an ongoing drama with negotiators flying back and forth to China and visiting here. There's, of course, in addition, the question of whether there will be a summit involving President Trump or not and Xi Jinping of China. Give us an update on what's going on and what you think should be going on.
Well, first of all, there is now no scheduled summit between President Trump and China's Xi Jinping. Last week, everyone expected that there would have been an announcement by President Trump on Thursday when he met with China's chief trade negotiator in the Oval Office, but it didn't happen. And I think it didn't happen because the Chinese are digging in their heels. They're getting to the point where they realize that they cannot make certain commitments. And this is an interesting dance because people had expected that there would have been a summit by the end of last month. Then they were saying this month. Now they're talking about May and June. I think right now the talks are at an impasse, although both sides won't say that. They say progress is being made, but I'm not so sure that that is the case.
Well, in fact, I think the president last week was talking about very considerable progress and how this is really shaping up and coming together and so on. And yet, Gordon, as you know, he has also said tariffs are not coming off the Chinese. And that would presumably be quite chilling to their willingness even to make commitments that everybody understands they're not going to honor, especially in the area of sort of structural reforms. So is this essentially evidence that the thing has basically come a cropper, as you see it?
Well, they're still talking, and there will be talks in the next 3 or 4 days or so. But President Trump's concept is absolutely the right one. You know, too often in the past, we have agreed to things with China basically because we've accepted their promises that they would do the right thing. They haven't done that. And we've got decades of failed trade agreements. President Trump has made an important switch in American policy by saying, no, we're not going to accept promises. We're going to keep those tariffs on. In other words, we're going to continue to impose costs until China actually complies. that's a very welcome change in policy. And I think that it will lead to much better trade relations. But in the interim, though, I think we're going to see much more friction in the trade talks than the sides are willing to admit.
Yeah, trade talks, among other sources of friction at the moment. Gordon, let me ask you about a couple of other things quickly. You have written in the National Interest that Xi, the president of China for life, is winning the national security war. Talk about that. And if I could ask you in particular to address an area that I think is a rising concern, I believe Wednesday will be the 40th anniversary of the enactment of what's known as the Taiwan Relations Act. Taiwan has been in the crosshairs of the Chinese, both figuratively and increasingly literally, for decades, of course. There seems, by the accounts of some of our colleagues specializing in military affairs, to be a growing possibility that the Chinese think they have the wherewithal to actually mount an amphibious assault with missile attacks and so on Taiwan to conquer it by force and to keep the United States at bay so it cannot come to the rescue. Give us a sense of is that what you have in mind, in part at least, with Xi's winning of the so-called national security war?
Well, that title came from National Interest. I probably would have chosen a different one. But we've got to be very clear that Beijing poses a direct threat to Taiwan at this particular time. Xi Jinping has been talking about Taiwan in increasingly bellicose terms over the last year, and that is an indication that the Chinese think that they can intimidate Taiwan and the United States. At this particular time, as we all know, the People's Liberation Army of China is developing the capabilities to take the island. And I think that there's a certain amount of psychological warfare where they believe that the United States can be intimidated. As you point out, we've got the 40th anniversary of the Taiwan Relations Act. What we need are stronger commitments on the part of the United States to defend Taiwan, because if there were a clear statement from the United States that we would defend Taiwan, I don't think the Chinese would actually try it. But right now, we have a policy continuing of strategic ambiguity where we don't tell either side what we would do. What we have seen, and this is a very good development or series of developments, is that the Trump administration is increasing cooperation with Taiwan across the board. And that is a message to China that the United States is standing with Taiwan, which we should absolutely do for the reasons we've talked about before.
Yeah. Yep. Let me switch gears with you, Gordon, because another ally that we have been having some increasing concerns about, that actually will have a meeting in the person of its president, Moon Jae-in, with President Trump this week in the White House, is South Korea. The concerns are not simply that there are increasing threats to South Korea, certainly from the Chinese, and I would argue from the North Koreans, but that the government of Moon Jae-in is actually increasing its vulnerability to such threats in pursuit of what I think of as kind of a separate peace. What do you expect will be on the agenda with the president this week? Do you anticipate that he will speak very firmly to his South Korean counterpart about the undermining of his diplomacy with North Korea that is the practical effect of what the South Korean government is currently doing? Gordon?
The primary item on Moon Jae-in's objective is to obtain sanctions relief for North Korea. In other words, the president of South Korea has really become the chief spokesman of Kim Jong-un, the North Korean dictator.
It's actually not just spokesman. You're talking about being their lobbyist, for heaven's sake.
Well, yes, of course. And this has been a consistent policy and posture on the part of Moon, who is very pro-North Korean and deeply anti-American. And just to give you a sense of this, U.S. Forces Korea helped in disaster relief in South Korea. There was virtually no mention of it in the South Korean press, which is increasingly controlled by the Moon administration. So we have a very dangerous figure coming to the White House who is nominally an ally. Now, most South Koreans don't agree with their president on this, but unfortunately, most South Koreans don't control the Blue House. And I hope that President Trump says a couple of things to Moon. One of them is to stop supporting North Korea, and the other is to stop undermining democracy in South Korea, because Moon is increasingly imposing controls, not only on the broadcast and traditional forms of media, but they're also threatening to censor social media platforms, because this is where conservative voices have taken, because they are not allowed onto the TV stations and into the main papers, by and large. So this whole notion that of allowing North Korea to take over South Korea, which Moon is very much in the forefront of, I hope President Trump raises it.
Gordon, let's just drill down on this for another moment, because I think it's so critical to our understanding of what President Trump is confronting here. Most Americans don't know much about South Korea, of course, let alone its government, to say nothing of the proclivities of its president. But in your book, Losing South Korea, you go into some detail about the radical anti-U.S. and pro-North Korean line that Moon Jae-in himself has hewed to for many years, as have a number of the key people that he has brought into positions of power in the Blue House and the government of South Korea more generally. Just give us a sense of what that means, what it means at an ideological level, what it means to North Korea to have this kind of friend in court, shall we say, and what it has meant on the ground in terms of the kinds of policies, in addition to suppressing democracy, what Moon Jae-in has done with respect to the demilitarized zone, for example.
The important thing there, Frank, is the September 2018 agreement between North and South Korea, which involved a withdrawal of forces, but it is structured in such a way that it undermines South Korea's ability to defend itself far more than it undermines North Korea's ability to attack. And so, therefore, many people are calling that agreement the surrender agreement. Now, I don't think it's quite that bad, but nonetheless, it does, in many ways, prevent the United States from effecting a defense of South Korea. And so we got to understand that Moon Jae-in's objective is political unification of North and South Korea, and he's willing to do it more or less on Kim Jong-un's terms. And that means that although we have a nominal ally in Seoul, basically President Trump is facing two Korean leaders who are trying to undermine attempts to denuclearize the peninsula. This has all sorts of implications, of course, and it makes diplomacy for the Trump administration extremely difficult.
It does indeed, and may give rise, in fact, to the loss of South Korea, as you have contemplated in your new book, at Encounter Books. Gordon Chang, as always, I appreciate so much your insights on all of these topics, and we look forward to having you addressing the roundtable of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. It will be live-streamed tomorrow, as well as available shortly thereafter at presentdangerchina.org. Gordon, thank you. We'll see you tomorrow.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by one of my favorite people in Washington. She gives lie to the idea that this is all a bunch of swamp creatures. Her name is Suzanne Schulte. She is Dr. Schulte to you and me. She is the president of a marvelous organization, the Defense Forum Foundation, and also chairs the North Korea Freedom Coalition. Suzanne has run for Congress, but mostly she's known for her tireless efforts to try to help the people of North Korea free themselves from the horrifically repressive, truly odious, and increasingly dangerous regime of Kim Jong-un. Suzanne, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Frank.
Well, we were talking with Gordon Chang a moment ago about the upcoming summit between President Trump and Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea. And he made some rather astonishing claims about what Moon is up to inside South Korea, including his efforts to prop up the regime of North Korea, to effectively behave as its lobbyist and even that his agenda is to reunify the peninsula more or less on North Korea's terms. Could that possibly be so?
Absolutely. And I just have to say that it seems almost implausible that a vibrant, free South Korea, an economic powerhouse, could be taken over by the world's most suffering suffering dictatorship. But Gordon's absolutely right. The objectives, we should never lose the fact that that has been the objective of the North Korea regime since its establishment, to take over South Korea. There's a couple things that Moon is doing that are extremely troubling. First of all, you'll notice that he never talks about the North Korea human rights. While the world community has acknowledged and come to the conclusion in 2014 through the UN Commission of Inquiry that the North Korea regime is committing unspeakable violations of human rights, crimes against humanity every day, the person who should care the most about that is the president of South Korea, because his family is actually from North Korea. He was rescued during the Korean War by America. So he never talks about North Korea human rights. He has stifled freedom of speech. He's jailed reporters. We're trying to get some of the organizations that work on freedom of the press to help look at this, but they've stifled freedom of the press. Where it's impacted me directly is they've cut off all the support for the North Korea defectors to do their work, whether it's balloon launches or radio broadcasting or just getting information into North Korea, which is the most important thing we should be doing. And I can tell you, we went to, for the first time, April last year, North Korea Freedom Week, which is coming up again later this month, we were stopped by hundreds of police from doing a balloon launch. That's never happened during North Korea Freedom Week. The previous governments before Moon, they sent police to make sure we weren't interfered with. They wanted to make sure that this is balloons where we're sending in leaflets of information into North Korea with the truth about South Korea and America, shortwave radios, U.S. $1 bills to help in the private markets. So, yes, Gordon is absolutely right, and people think it's implausible, but, you know, This whole talk that Moon has been putting out there about establishing a confederation where they would unify and vote and have this loosely held confederation, well, this could be a mechanism for the North taking over the South. And here's why. If you had an election and everyone in Korea got to vote, the South Koreans would probably have several candidates. They usually always have several candidates for president. And if you had Kim Jong-un running from North Korea, who would win? Kim Jong-un, because all the North Koreans would vote for Kim Jong-un.
They would all vote for him, and it appears some number of South Koreans, at least if Moon Jae-in is any guide, would do so too.
That's why Bill Clinton got elected president, because Ross Perot ran against when Bush was running for re-election. So we may find it implausible, but that's the scenario that's been laid out. And I think Gordon has been raising the alarm bell about this for some time now, but also the way that they've changed the textbooks. This has been an ongoing process by the leftist, the pro-Kim Jong-un actors in South Korea to really rewrite history, to say that the real problem that Korea has, and this is really, really horrible thing for people to be aware of, but young people in up through the 20s and 30s, people in their 30s, believe that the reason why Korea is divided is because of the United States. They think we cause the problems, that Japan and America are imperialist countries, and we're the source of their problems. And this is what they've done. They've changed the history. And I know that's happened in the United States, too, where people don't understand communism.
It's the same techniques, isn't it? At the end of the day, it's the sort of communist or Marxist march through the institutions, and it's evident there and well as here if you look for it. Let me ask you about, you of course have touched upon your own really important work on the North Korea Freedom Coalition, Suzanne Schulte, and that of many others with whom you work on the ground in South Korea, trying to help the people of the North learn the truth, get access to information, be able to be more hopefully influential within that society, or maybe get out of it if they can. I wanted to ask you about this article that appeared in, of all places, Gentleman's Quarterly, in which it talked about the Underground Railroad, which has been operating to try to help people flee North Korea, an exceedingly dangerous and difficult thing to do. Yet you've worked with quite a number of defectors or refugees, if you will, that have made the trip. Talk a little bit about this railroad. Talk a bit about the effort that's being made to try to get people out of this horrifically repressive regime's grip.
Here's the problem. China refuses to recognize North Korean refugees that cross from the North Korea-China border on their way to try to get to South Korea. They refuse to recognize them as refugees, and they say, well, they're economic migrants because they're leaving North Korea because they're hungry or they're looking for work. So they do not give them any kind of protections. And then as a result, 80% of the North Koreans that cross that border, the women, are trafficked. And it's a horrific situation because the moment they cross that border, they meet the definition of asylum seeker because it's a crime punishable by death to leave North Korea without permission. So all these people, when they're arrested and sent back, they will 100% be tortured, 100% be detained, and in some cases executed because they tried to flee. If they find out they were trying to get to South Korea, they find out they became in contact with a Christian, they'll get executed or sent to a political prison camp. So it's a horrible situation. It's all created by China's refusal to honor its international treaty obligations, because what China's doing is violating their international law, because they're a signer to the Refugee Convention.
And of course, what China is more broadly doing is enabling this regime in North Korea. It's only there because of their efforts to perpetuate it. And let me ask you, Suzanne, there's a story that appeared in the Washington Post about Vietnam after the summit with President Trump and Kim Jong-un taking place on its soil, deciding to send back refugees, as they call them, to North Korea to meet what the Post rather blithely called an uncertain fate. From what you've just described, it's a certitude what their fate is going to be and the horrific fate that it is indeed.
Well, the Washington Post has reported about this, and they know that these people are going to be subjected definitely to torture. And it's certainly, if they got as far as Vietnam and they were trying to get to South Korea, they will be killed or they will be sent to a political prison camp, which is basically a death sentence. So that's what's going to happen when anybody is sent back to North Korea. And this is the thing. Kim Jong-un fears his own people more than anything else, because it's the North Korean people that have educated us to understand that regime and what that regime is all about. So he's afraid of his own people, because when they do get to South Korea, they often get involved in speaking out and getting involved in getting information in. And I'm a big believer the truth will set them free. That was the theme last year of North Korea Freedom Week, and trying to get information into North Korea. That was the theme of North Korea Freedom Week. The day before North Korea Freedom Week started, Moon Jae-in met with Kim Jong-un and said they were going to stop all efforts to get information into North Korea, turn off the loudspeakers. And that had been a goal of the Park and the Lee governments before, was to let people in North Korea know the truth.
Well, I hope Donald Trump will speak the truth to Moon Jae-in, specifically that he must cease and desist what he is doing, the South Korean president, to embolden, at a minimum, the North Koreans, undermine the president's diplomatic efforts to denuclearize North Korea, and otherwise perpetuate this scourge of the earth, the Kim Jong-un regime. Suzanne Schulze, you're doing your part. We're so grateful to you for it and for joining us from time to time to give us updates. I hope you'll do so after this meeting between the president and Moon. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.